listening to www.earthcycles.net. This is Govinda with Brenda Norell. bsnorell.blogspot.com on the longest walk to longestwalk.org. We are where are we today?
Cimarron, Kansas.
Cimarron.
Govinda never knows where we are.
Well, what time did we get here? 6:30?
Well, we pulled out of the armory over at, Garden City, Kansas, before first light. We got up about 4:30. I guess the armory guys, the National Guard, had something to do this morning. We cleaned up faster than I've ever seen that group clean up. We really got out of there quick. Anyway, we're very happy to be here in Cimarron. And I'm very happy that we have something to talk about besides slaughterhouses. And
we wanted to dedicate that first song to all the cattle out there, 5,700 head every day that get slaughtered out there at the Tyson.
At Holcomb.
In Holcomb. And all the trucks, it's just phenomenal how many cattle trucks there are and where we are with the feedlots. And that all, it just sort of seems just a little strange.
And real nice people everywhere in Kansas. Thanks to all the librarians and waitresses and people who have hosted us. Great hospitality here. I'm going to let the family that just joined us from New Zealand introduce themselves so I don't mispronounce their names. And we'll start over here.
Okay. I'm Midi Hooker.
Yeah, and you'll have to speak real loud into that mic right there.
I'm Midi Hooker.
Midi, is that it?
Midi Hooker.
Midi Hooker.
Midi.
And how old are you?
15.
It's interesting, the enunciation.
Kia ora. My name is Sharon Hitta, and I come from a country called Aotearoa, New Zealand. Aotearoa in my language means land of the long white cloud. I am an indigenous native to Aotearoa, New Zealand. We are commonly referred to as Maori. But of course, within that context of being Maori, we are also from different tribal nations. And the tribal nation that I come from and belong to is the Tūhoe Independent Tribal Nation. Kia ora.
All right.
Hi, my name is Michael Lane. I'm not from Aotearoa originally. I'm from Great Turtle Island, Menominee. And I'm also a veteran of the original Longest Walk, 1978. Among other things.
Hello, I'm Derui here. And I'm 9.
How was the flight coming over here?
It was all right.
And your school?
Hi, I'm Ranito. I'm 9 years old.
Where do you go to school?
I go to school at Dawera in New Zealand.
All right. Well, gosh, it must be great fun coming over here and just seeing all this stuff. And is school out of session, or did you get out of school to actually participate in this thing? Is school still happening?
Yep.
And so you're over here, and school's happening over there.
Yep.
Did the teacher send you with a lot of homework?
Yes.
And are you doing a special report on the longest walk and what you're seeing here in the United States?
Yeah.
And how's that coming?
All right.
What are some of the significant things that you've seen or experienced here that are different from where you come from? I was going to try to say
Aotearoa.
Aotearoa.
Just spell the vowels like Spanish. Just say the vowels like Spanish, and you'll be all right.
Okay, I have to write it down, I guess, and then I'll know what that means.
Maybe let her sister talk a little bit about, she's a teenager, and maybe explain a little bit about what she's doing here on the walk. What was the question?
Just why you're here.
I'm here because my parents married me.
So what grade of school are you in? What kind of...
I'm year 11, which is like...
10th grade.
Yeah, 10th grade here.
How many years do they have over where you are?
They go up to year 13.
Uh-huh.
Which is, I don't know...
12th grade.
Yeah.
And so what are you studying over there? Do you have like a focus that you're working on? Or is it all just pretty generic, like they have the high schools
here?
Yeah,
it's just the same here. Yeah.
And what is some of the significant things that you've seen in terms of cultural differences coming into the United States?
I don't know, like, the culture is pretty much the same over in New Zealand. Like, Indian and Māori is basically the same.
Okay. We're going to let your... Mom and Dad talk a little bit about now. Whatever you want to talk about first, about the longest walk, 1978, or about what's been happening in your country with the oppression there. Who would like to go first?
Hello. Kia ora, everybody. This is Sharon again. I'd just like to share with you all at this time that on the 15th of October 2007 in Aotearoa, New Zealand, in the tribal territories of the Tūhoe Nation, my people were subjected to... and violated and abused when police and paramilitary ninjas, all dressed in black with loaded weapons, blockaded our roads and prevented my people from going about their daily business of going to work, of going to school, and even going to the store. My people were forced to get out of their vehicles at gunpoint. They were forced to have their photographs taken. And from that early Monday morning, this is what happened to them. And at the same time, police raided several homes within our tribal territories and throughout the country. And my family were one of the families that were subjected to a search warrant and police raids. Basically, that we were the suspects and for terrorism. And that's why we're here on this longest walk too, to be able to share that the message about our violations of our human rights and our violations of... who we are as an Indigenous people of Aotearoa, New Zealand, and that if we want to stand up and assert ourselves as an independent, sovereign nation who did not enter into any treaties, then we are labelled terrorists. And that is just not right. So my family and I are here on the... and participating on this longest walk to share that message and to seek sustenance and nourishment by being here on the longest walk with the indigenous nations of Turtle Island in the United States.
You've got a couple pieces of paper there, and what are they indicating?
These were flyers that were prepared for distribution to the general public, which sets out in a very succinct way that the police brutalities and violations that occurred to us as a tribal peoples on the 15th of October 2007 is not new to our tribe. That in fact in the 1800s, our tribal nations were subjected to the militia and the redcoats when they entered into our tribal territories and murdered our peoples, raped our women and children, and took away our lands. And even as we enter into the 1900s, the militia and the New Zealand police once again entered into our tribal territories, murdered and raped our women, children and men, herded us like cattle into the rivers and took away our lands. And now in the year 2007, this is still occurring where the police and paramilitary ninja type militia people have entered into our territories again simply because they believe that we as an indigenous tribal nation are terrorists because we stand up and assert ourselves as an independent sovereign nation.
What are some of the issues specific? I imagine that the dominant culture is looking at exploiting some mineral rights, minerals or water. They seem to usually have some pretext other than that. But
I think clearly, because our tribe did not enter into a treaty relationship with the Crown, British Crown, there's definitely well, in our tribal territories we have our environment is mainly native bush, rivers, trees, native trees, birds, and access to them is limited because as a tribe, we did not enter into a treaty relationship with our government, our British Crown. And so, from our perspective, we are still a sovereign nation of our territories.
So gradual encroachment issues are sort of like the way things are going, that they've slowly sort of filled up your lands, and now they're just harassing you more.
Well, what happened was the Declaration on the Rights of Indigenous People was passed at the United Nations, but New Zealand and Australia and the United States, Canada and Russia did not vote in favor of the Declaration. And then just right after that, there was this enormous oppression of the Maori people. It seemed to me it was more directed at the sovereign status of the people, as if to say, not only are we not going to vote for the UN Declaration on the Rights of Indigenous People, but we're going to squash you at the same time, meaning to try and rip their sovereign powers away from them. I know a number of people were arrested, and I don't know if they're all out of jail now.
Yes, there were a number of people that were arrested. However, they have received bail and are now awaiting what we call a depositions hearing that is due to come before the court in September, for the whole month of September this year. A depositions hearing is a hearing to see whether the Crown has a case or not to go to trial. At this time, it is believed that the Crown has over 300 of my people, Tūhoe people, who are to be witnesses, which I find really, really quite staggering, given what they have, given that how they have violated our people. In saying that, Brenda is correct. The New Zealand government did not sign nor support the Declaration on the Rights of Indigenous Peoples. And it's, from my own personal viewpoint, it's quite clear that they have, that there is an agenda out there to extinguish our customary rights, extinguish our sovereign right as an Indigenous nation. And at this time, there is a policy that is before the select committees and government at this time, a policy that is known as Waka Umanga. Now, Waka Umanga is a policy where the intention of that policy is to corporatise Māori, to corporatise our distinct cultural and tribal ways, to ensure that we are no longer, to sever that sovereign relationship that we have with our lands, with our mountains, with our awa, our rivers. Their policy is intended to ensure that we are no longer an independent sovereign nation, but a management type unit, where we are perceived as management units.
So much like what they're trying to do in Alaska with the corporations, where actually as a member of the, you become like, shareholders and actually assets at the same time. So you actually, the corporation owns your being.
That is correct.
From my limited knowledge, and I know that my husband Michael Lane can expand on that further, that would be, you would be correct on that. It is about ripping out our heart and soul.
And owning it.
Owning and controlling everything, our ways. And that is something that's right on the government's agenda right now.
You want to add to that a little bit?
Yeah, if I could kind of go back a little bit in time first and then kind of segue into it. Oh, and I'll bring this mic forward.
Yeah.
Okay, yeah, basically, I'd like to start back in 1978. and the reason I like to do that is the original Longest Walk was started in relation to 11 pieces of anti-Indian legislation. Of course, the one that people were most aware of was the one that terminated all treaties. I think people knew even at the time that didn't have little likelihood of passing, but it wasn't a protest walk, and that's the first thing I want to clarify, because a lot of people have portrayed the 1978 Longest Walk as a protest walk against the legislation. It was initiated in relation to the legislation, but it soon became something other than a protest walk. It was indeed a spiritual walk for tribal sovereignty, traditional tribal sovereignty. And that's what we were walking for. And those 11 pieces of legislation were ways of interfering with traditional tribal sovereignty. So we weren't walking against the legislation. We were walking for tribal sovereignty, and the opposing legislation was only a part of that. I don't think the goal was ever to say, we're going to lobby Congress, and then everything's honky-dory. And I don't think those of us that were on that walk for and walked the miles didn't think that way about it. You could even say D.C. was rather anticlimactic in that regard. And the main reason being is that from that perspective that we had, that walk didn't end. And you know, I noticed when I came in here, I've been saying it for years, and I see other people have saying it. It's on the poster on this very bus. you know, the longest walk did not end in Washington, D.C. And so it will be for the people that are on this walk, that have the young people here on this walk that have walked and ran. They, too, will continue to carry on these things long after this walk is a memory. And so that's the kind of things that one of the reasons we want to come here is give to our children, that feeling of that taste of freedom. That's the something that a taste you never lose that hunger for. No matter how you try to hide it, some people may have tried to hide it through trying to get a good paying job, just that work, or they may have gone to drink, or they may have gone to drug. But those of us that are on it, it always call you back. No matter what you do, it calls you back. So you can't help but come back to that walk in some way, shape, or form. And for myself, it led me to many places. Aim for Freedom Survivor Group in Oakland, and a number of other places, including Aotearoa, where I ended up meeting my wife, and we have three children. So that walk continues, and that's how it is for those of us that have been on it. And before I seg you, I'd also like to honor the memory of those that went most of the way that I can remember that have passed on, that aren't able to be with us anymore on this walk in the physical form. And I'd just like to say a few of the names I remember, and I apologize if I have omitted anybody. It's not by oversight, but the ones I would like to acknowledge would be known as Robert Buxkin at the time. He was head security on the walk along with Sonny McNoyce. He passed away a few years ago, and his grandson is on it, and his son's going to soon be on it. And last night we were able to present a T-shirt to Jimbo and Adriano, his adopted son, commemorating him in his role as on the walk. And I would also like to acknowledge Fern Mathias, who has been long an AIM person, and she passed away a few years ago. Bob Tishkai, Audrey Brown died soon after the walk, a couple years after. John White Fox, some of you guys may have known John White Fox because he was involved in a lot of Bay Area politics, for better or for worse, as some would say. And those are some of the ones I can think of at the moment. Oh, and Frank Robbins from up in Yurok country. Trying to remember who else. Anyway, those are the ones I can remember right now, but I'd just like to remember those, and I'm sure I'll remember. Oh, my gosh. And all those that have still carried on that walk in their various work. And also I'd like to honor Bill Wapapa, even though he wasn't on the walk, but he helped organize the original longest walk and was a mentor to a lot of us, including Jimbo Simmons, who was the first person to pledge to go all the way on the original longest walk. And since it was the first one of its kind, you could say he's the first person to pledge to go on one of these walks at all. So we have to remember that Jimbo was a very dedicated person even back then, as a young man. And that he was the first person to pledge to go all the way. People shouldn't forget that. In any event, but I speak about the issue of what the walk was really about, because it leads us to the present day. There's no bills in Congress saying they're going to terminate treaties. There's no thing that says, policy that says we want to terminate Indian nations. But yet that's exactly what they're doing. And it was the four of the five countries that didn't sign that declaration, they formed a group called Kansas a few years back, sort of like a policy think tank. And those were Canada, Australia, New Zealand, and the United States.
And how appropriate, we're in Kansas.
Yes, I was thinking of that. There was no coincidence. In any event, that group has been clearly making joint policy statements. If you make a matrix of the policies that are occurring in those four nations, there's a convergence happening. And that convergence is towards a form of tribal termination called corporatization. And if you look at the termination policies of the 1950s that were allegedly repudiated, the end result of those termination policies were corporate structures where you were subjected to state authority, and had your lands were alienable under state law, and your identity was determined by the state, and your rights were determined by the state. There were some exceptions to that. I'm not going to get into those details because they're complicated. and legalistic. But in any event, generally speaking, if you look at corporatization stage two, you have the Alaska Native Claims Settlement Act. And then if you look at what's going on in Canada in the 80s and into the 90s with the James Bay Northern Quebec Agreement, if you look at some of the municipality agreements they did with different, you could say that's termination stage three where they get alleged consent. And even some of the treaty settlements that have occurred in Aotearoa. Because one of those settlements, the Sea Lord deal in the early 90s, that actually corporatized fishing rights for Maori. In other words, Maori fishing rights were put into a commercial company called Sea Lord, and that's their fishing rights are tied to that commercial company. And it's not just their commercial fishing rights, but a lot of people don't realize it's the customary fishing rights as well. So that was corporatized back in the early 90s. Now, recently, New Zealand, for example, did the Seabed and Foreshore Act where they basically changed the rules on Aboriginal title and unilaterally extinguished it without consultation or consent. And that's a whole new kettle of fish from a legal perspective. But they did it in such a way, it's subtle, because the reason they did it was to stop the exercise of a key customary right, which is tribal sovereignty or self-government. And that key customary right is under extreme threat in the United States by these compacts that they do for tribes to get casinos. And I'm not speaking against casinos because they have been a major boon for economic development for many tribal nations. And even though there's some problems with it and some people will be critical of it for other reasons, that's not what I'm talking about. What I'm talking about here is that the compacts themselves that the United States government has required has opened a door where states are assuming more and more jurisdiction. And you can see that door getting wider and wider. And it's not because tribal people aren't fighting against that, but because the government that was their key intent in the first place, to keep opening that door. And we shouldn't have to fight to keep that door closed just to pursue economic development that they've been denying us for so long. And and if you look at what's happening in Canada with the First Nation Governance Act and what they're doing with the British Columbia Treaty process, what they're doing is they're putting agreements across where if you agree to it, you end up getting some money, you get municipal powers from the government. They're not inherent rights. If you have an inherent right, it pre-exists that government. But instead, they're changing it so you get a right from the Crown, or your right from the Canadian government, and in essence, you operate like a corporation. If you look at the Waka Umanga Act that Sharon was talking about, you know, it's the same thing. In New Zealand, they don't recognize the legal personality. In other words, they won't deal with the tribe itself. They will only deal with a Crown-created entity, whether it be a charitable trust or an incorporated society. And now what they want to do is consolidate that into a corporate entity registered with the company's office called Waka Umanga, where the Crown, and it won't just represent assets held by the tribe, it will represent their interests and social interests. They don't recognize tribal sovereignty in New Zealand. And so that's why when a tribal nation stands up and says, you know, we are tribally sovereign, not talking about overthrowing New Zealand, not throwing the Pakeha back to England or anything like that, just standing up and saying, we're a tribal sovereign nation, they think it's either A, a joke, or B, terroristic activity. One or the other, you know, one extreme or the other. And so these kind of things, there's a common thread among them all. It's a common convergence towards corporatizing tribes into something manageable that comes from these governments rather than it comes from something inherent that pre-exists those governments. And that's what they're trying to do. And that's why they do what they do today. And one of the key ways of doing that, the two things they do, take your identity and take the things that relate you to land. Because what we are as indigenous peoples is tied to the land, sacred sites. And so that's why this walk is very important. Because what it's doing is talking about protecting sacred sites. It's not just talking about things that are platable to various other interests. It's talking about protecting traditional tribal sovereignty as well. They're inextricably linked. They're inherent issues that are inextricably linked. So when you try and take a people's spiritual relationship to the land away, you're trying to destroy their indigenous identity. So you may recognize them, you may give them a plot of land, but once you take that, you know, once you take a generation forgets who they are, the young people forget who they are, you know, where does that indigenous identity go? And the governments know this. You know, they've been around. They've done heaps of studies. They, you know, there's millions of sociological impact reports on this kind of stuff. So it's not a thing that can be debated. It's quite clear. You destroy that spiritual identity. You destroy that identity as tribal people. So they may exist in name, but it'll be just a corporate brand. And that seems to be the common convergence of these four nation states. But that's just a couple of words.
Are you an attorney?
Well, I actually do have a law degree from Arizona State University.
Now, how did I know that?
But I don't practice an attorney. I practice supporting tribal sovereignty.
What kind of work do you do, if you don't mind me asking?
Right now, I'm unemployed.
like most everyone else on the longest walk.
It seems, but before that, what's one of the things we had to struggle? We had a big struggle. We were supposed to be here in February, but of course we had no money. And it's very difficult to, my work is intermittent because I do, that's what I work in, and I believe I have integrity. But actually, you know, having integrity can work against you when it comes to employment.
So have you been in New Zealand all the years since the longest walk?
No. I just moved there 10 years ago. I've been in a few places before that. And I used to, when we first met in 89, I was a first-year law student in Arizona State. And she was a first-year law student at Auckland University. And
how
I was there.
How did you meet?
The Waitangi Action Committee had linked up with the I used to work for International Treaty Council. I was a part of the Aim for Freedom Survivor Group back in Oakland from back in the late 70s, early 80s. And when we restarted the office in 81, and I was part of that. When Bill Walpole restarted the San Francisco office in 81, I was working there. And we made some connections with Maori in 83. They came out to Ohone Hauteruita, came out to Philip Deers. At the Elders and Youth Gathering there and the Treaty Council Conference there. And then from there, that relationship developed between International Union Treaty Council and the Waitangi Action Committee, representing a lot of, I guess you could say, something similar to American Indian Movement in Aotearoa. And through those actions, we hosted a number of people, including his sister, Hine Whare, who traveled around with us quite a bit. And then Hini Rirangi is now the current delegate for International Treaty Council. But I was invited over. I had helped facilitate quite a few people over. I had never been over myself because I had gone to that Nuclear Free Independent Pacific Conference in 83 in Vanuatu. In any event, I went over in 89 through an externship in my law school, and then... Well, you know, things happen.
The question is, where did we meet?
Oh, we met at a talk by a fellow named Moana Jackson talking about Maori justice. And she was a law student over there, and we just started talking, and then, well, things happened. Anyway, we got in a bit of trouble. Created a little bit of a stir, controversy getting together, but... 18
why
years later.
Why the controversy?
Oh, well, you know how it is with other, you know, when indigenous peoples from one place come and hook up with indigenous people from another place, some of the people say, why are you going over there? Things like that. But it all settled down. And I was going back and forth quite a bit for a number of years and until I settled over there. I just moved over there in 97. But, yeah, I've been involved in quite a few other issues and activities in the interim.
Do you want to tell us some of the highlights of the other actions?
Well, they're basically just supporting tribal sovereignty issues. I know the fellow that was on the longest walk, we used to do the uranium mining research for Aim for Freedom Survivor. I can remember being laughed at for talking about climate change as a big issue for indigenous peoples back in 79. Bill and them used to laugh at me, thinking I was crazy. Hey, it's a big issue now. So I feel rather vindicated. But in any event, no, I've been involved in a lot of, you know, and of course I went to law school. I haven't practiced as a lawyer per se, but I've been involved in a lot of community law projects and things like that. I don't know.
You bring up a really interesting point about crushing the spirit of a people by, you know, stealing their identity and their connection with the land. And, you know, it's very fascinating to me because it brings the spirit, the emotion of, you know, a lot of folks in this culture have this very externalized sense of who they are. And they don't, I don't know that people, I think people have lost touch with their spiritual identity and connection with the land. And it's interesting that the kind of stuff that was going on in the 12th century, the 16th century, is still happening today with this intention. And the use of fear and power to kind of disrupt that. And then the corporatization of humankind, it makes me aware of the fact that we drive through these cattle ranches. I mean, where there are, what would you say, a couple thousand head of cattle in like an acre piece of land.
They're called feedlots.
Feedlots. Okay, so they're hunt. I mean, they're just, it's, and you can smell them way before you can see them.
Oh yeah.
But it sort of makes me feel like that's the agenda of the dominant culture, or this what did you call that group? The Kansas group.
We're not in Kansas anymore.
Yeah, that there's some kind of agenda, and it brings like the Matrix movie back into focus and all kinds of really hideous thoughts.
Well, I'm interested, after all the oppression by the police and, of course, many people being arrested, many protests. I know the International Indian Treaty Council came out with a statement of support. But what has been the result of all that? What's happening right now in New Zealand?
Terrorism charges have been dropped.
Okay. Thank you, Brenda. At this time, the terrorism charges that have been dropped and have been reduced now to firearms charges. So that's what's happened now. What a surprise that is. The other thing, too, is that we've had leading lawyers in the country offer their services to our tribe. Bring a case against the police, and also another leading lawyer in the country who heads the Police Independent Conduct Authority, who made a special trip out to our tribal area to speak with all my people that were affected by the police raids, and hear their stories, and share with them what happened. And we, at this time, we have a website that keeps track of what's going on in the area. I can give you that website if you like.
Right now?
Right now, yes.
Yeah.
It's well, you can Google it. Google. I have to spell it for you because it's in our language. Yeah. Oh, good.
No,
yeah.
I'd like her to say it so the people listening can know what.
If you go to Google and Google, and the name is Te Kotahi A Tūhoe. See,
there's
so.
The pen.
Like I said, I'll have to spell it because, Te Kotahi A Tūhoe. And what that means is when together as one, we are strong. We are together. Te Kotahi A Tūhoe. And that's, if you go to Google and Google that, and I'll give you the spelling, it's there, T-E space K-O-T-A-H-I space A space T-U-H-O-E.
Okay, let's do that one more time. You want to read it one more time?
Okay, I'll give it to Brendan.
Well, I'm just going to Google it.
Okay, I'd like to read it. I'd like for the listeners to be able to find it. So that would be T-E space K-O-T-A-H-I A-T-U-H-O-E. Okay, so you can check on, do a Google on that, and hopefully you'll find out a little bit more and follow what's going on. Has there been any, like, discussion in reference to the purging of the soul of a people and this ownership of a corporate ownership thought form that the dominant cultures are pushing?
All I know is that, like, we have law degrees, and it's hard to get this stuff. You know, it's hard to read through this stuff. I know I've been fortunate because I've actually lived in three of the countries, New Zealand, U.S., and Canada, and deal with these issues on a regular basis. And it was hard for me to get a grasp on it. I'm not saying I'm a super genius or anything either. But, although I might. No, just kidding. the reason I say that, though, is because of my unusual circumstances and stuff, not too many people have been exposed to three different countries on a direct level and that level. And so the information is there, but it's not easy to see. I mean, it's really not easy to grasp because it's quite sophisticated and subtle now. And so it really does require a bit of a exposure to different things that allows people to see that, and not too many people have that exposure or that experience of traveling among the different. Because, you know, if you go just over the border, I was teaching in a place in Thunder Bay in Canada for a while. The students were from both Grand Portage and Fort Williams, and they were related. And the ones from Fort Williams knew very little about their relations. They knew their relations, but they didn't know anything about how their reservation worked on the other side of the border. They knew who the people were. And vice versa is probably true as well. We don't really know too much, even though we say, oh, this is the U.S., this is Canada, and that border doesn't exist for us, but yet we're still controlled a lot by the parameters that are put on by the colonizing nation states. And they keep us separate in our thinking. But so as they converge their policies together, we may stay in a solidarity, but we're not in a position right now. We're not actually coordinating. And that's actually something that hopefully by the end of this walk, with the issues that come up from the grassroots level, that some of that stuff will be addressed. And because I know that one of the things that people are looking at is, of course, getting these nation states to sign the Declaration on the Rights of Indigenous Peoples. I know I've heard that the issue has been put to the Democratic candidates. I don't know what the response has been over here to Obama. And actually, I don't know if someone should put it to McCain, because he's actually been somewhat sympathetic to Indian issues. You know, he's a Republican.
I think someone should put it to Chertoff before they put it to anybody, because Chertoff seems to have made himself king.
Made himself God. He just waved NAGPRA and the American Indian.
Yeah, I've just seen that on their blog today.
But also, did you know that the Canadian Parliament has endorsed?
Yeah, I just seen that on your blog as well.
Well, geez, that's a great advertisement.
So check out bsnorell.blogspot.com for the latest news about what's happening in your world.
And there is talk that the new Prime Minister of Australia may actually sign it, too.
But then the next thing is implementation of a strategy or a project, doing something or not. And in reference to getting the listening audience and folks out there, once you become mindful of what's happening, what needs to be done to change this kind of thinking?
Well, that's for wiser heads than mine. I don't want to put myself in that seat. But I just think it's really important that people support things like this walk, and those that are us that are trying to do things, not lobbying the government, but reestablishing our traditional ties to the land, and those that are trying to do that, and supporting those people that are doing that. And at the end of the day, you come from that strength, and then we say that the other things will flow out of that, eh? And so the wiser heads will then have more wisdom coming their way.
Well, and so I think that brings back the fact that you're listening to The Longest Walk, to a prayer, an intention, a commitment to traditional knowledge, and not only traditional knowledge, but the youth that are going to be here to carry on the wisdom of that. So do track on longestwalk2.org. bsnorell.blogspot.com.
I'm going to ask you a question that a member of the Mohawk Warrior Society asked, and that's,
why march to Washington, D.C.? Why should Native people care what the leaders in Washington think?
I know for myself, I don't give a hoot what they think. I can't speak for anyone else. I don't care. What's important is, and I remember it was told to us that we were walking to, you know, when we walk in a spiritual path, you know, east to west, it's just a place, eh? It's a way of, like, this walk is about recommemorating the original one. That's why we're here on the northern route. And I'm not criticizing the southern route either in saying that, but I'm just saying that's why we're on the northern route. It's not about lobbying Washington, D.C. I think that thought was there a while back. I don't think that's there anymore. I think it's just simply, you know, it's just recapturing that spiritual energy that happened in the original Longest Walk is part of what this is about. And whether or not anyone listens in D.C. at this stage, you know, big deal.
Well, you know, the other part is that it was brought to my attention, this is the Santa Fe Trail, and that it became the Santa Fe Trail, or the main freeway, so to speak, for wagon trains, because it was the indigenous, the natives here trade route moving across the country. So that it's, you know, not only is it a commemoration of the 1978 walk, but it's also a commemoration of traditional knowledge and infrastructure that was actually established here long before the Eurocentric genocidal sickness came in.
I think it's also important for people to read the Longest Walk Manifesto from 78, because if you read that, you can see that it wasn't it wasn't about political lobbying per se. And the Longest Walk Manifesto was endorsed by the participants, and it talks about the relationship with the natural world and natural law and representing those issues. And we don't mean the natural law theory of St. Thomas Aquinas. Hey. No, we're talking about the natural law from the land itself. And so it's really important that people take a look at that manifesto, because it still is valid today.
If we have a copy of it, would you like to read it?
No. It's very long. Unless you have an hour.
Yeah. Well, we have eternity.
We have infinity. Yes.
Well, I mean, I can see that it's very long, isn't it? It's like 30 pages.
Yeah.
And I did post the website already on bsnoel.blogspot.com.
And it is posted at the longestwalk.org website.
Yeah.
If you look in the document section, they have posted the manifesto on there. Although I believe it's missing a page.
On the website?
Only an attorney would notice that. How many pages is it?
Oh, it's about 25.
Yeah, 25. That might be a stretch. I'd like to hear about your community there. Just a little bit about the way of life there and how it compares to maybe not Kansas, but I'm sure you don't have slaughterhouses and...
No Walmarts.
You don't have Walmarts?
No.
Our feedlots? But no Walmarts, maybe you could share with our readers, our listeners, just what it's like there.
we come from mainly rural. Is that how you say it? Rural location, and so very, very small towns. Yeah. But in saying that, we have a strong connection, very strong connections to our native forests and what we call the bush, and to our rivers. And so a large, most of our tribal territories is what you call pristine, native indigenous environment. Mm. A lot of our people, particularly our men, are hunters. We have what we call marae, which are like a gathering place for our people to gather to discuss issues that impact and affect them on a daily basis, to carry out our traditional ceremonies in relation to funerals and deaths, to celebrate birthdays, to gather and discuss issues that have impacted on us regarding the police raids on our communities. We're very much community oriented minded peoples, yeah. And we're trying very hard to maintain our cultural language and traditions. And so the majority of the tribe that I belong to in Tūhoe continue to speak their native language as their first language.
All right. Well, hey, I see the little ones are getting a little restless, and maybe it's time to take a break and go outside and get something else going on. Is there something else that you would, another comment that you would like to leave the listeners with before we break up here for a bit?
You can send donations for the longest walk too. they need help. We need help. We've just gotten here a few days, so. We have to reorient ourselves.
I hope you like gravy.
Yeah. But, donations are always needed to help out. I'm sure that they'll tell you where to send them if they haven't been already. And also, eat good for us.
Tell us about your plans. How long will you be with a walk?
Oh, we'll be going all the way to the end, and then we will be meandering back via more northern route, further north. In and out of Canada and across, because I've got to do a few things to finish off some things.
Okay, and do you want to say hello to anyone who might be listening, either in New Zealand or anywhere else?
Do they get this in New Zealand?
Yes, this is worldwide.
It's on the web.
Maybe girls would like to say hello to your friends back home. Maybe somebody will hear it.
Hello, Waititi. And maybe Huka.
Savannah, I sent you the link to this website where this is playing, so. You better be listening.
It's recorded, too, so you can
It'll be archived, so you can come back and listen to it later as well.
So I know you guys were out there walking in the cold, and this is some of the coldest weather, really, because of the wind and the rain and hail the last couple of days. So what do you think so far? Are you thinking, oh, what have we done or what? were you expecting this cold? I mean, I thought it would be warmer this time of year in Kansas.
I wasn't expecting it to rain, and it was so cold, yeah. But today it's been all right today, although it's windy, you know, it's been a good day. It's been a good day to walk, yeah.
Our tent's still drying out, though.
It was really a hard rain over in Syracuse, and it was extremely cold mixed with some hail and snow, and it didn't stop for several days, and it was pretty difficult, I think, for the people out on the highway. And how are your muscles? What, have you walked a couple days now? And did you have blisters yet?
One of my daughters has blisters.
Well, good. That's sort of a medal of honor. What, 9 years old, was it?
Yeah.
Are you nine? Nine, yeah. And already got your first blister for the longest walk. It's a badge of. Is there anything else you'd like to say before we move on to something else this morning?
I'd just like to thank you, Brenda, for asking us to participate on the show and the opportunity to be able to share with the listeners some of the issues that are occurring right now in in my country, Aotearoa, New Zealand. So thank you very much.
Thank you. I was in Tonga. My daughter spent a year there in Tonga, and I loved it very much, the South Pacific.
And I'd just like to thank Govinda for reminding us of why we may have to rethink eating at Sonic Burger. It's interesting that the Sonic Burger in Garden City, where all those feedlots were, it was packed.
Wow.
I've never seen so many people eat so many burgers.
And tell us again the story about bologna.
Oh, bologna, and much like sausage, they after all this cutting is done for the choice pieces, they shovel up all the scraps and run it through a grinder, and then throw in the spices and the nitrates to keep it from turning green. Otherwise, it would all be kind of a greenish kind of slime.
The
color.
Long Walk had bologna in their ice chest today.
Yeah, well, and also, on that note, we should also remind folks that 400,000 pounds of cow meat was recalled from someplace here in Kansas because the tonsil material wasn't completely removed, and that's part of the mad cow body part.
I think I'm going to be a vegetarian by the time I get across Kansas. I mean, my introduction to Kansas was a cattle truck passing in front of me when I was crossing the road over near the border, and the cows leaving a trail behind them for me to walk in.
And with that said, we're going to go back to the Dana Lyons Cows with Guns song, and we'll be back in
Thanks
just
so
a few
much
moments.
Thanks so much to our guests from New Zealand.
You're listening
to The Longest Walk.
You're listening to www.earthcycles.net, bsnorell.blogspot.com, longestwalk2.org. Thanks for listening. It's